Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Hello, my name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night, and it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight, we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. Tonight's broadcast is part two of the fascinating story of one of the biggest drug kingpins of his era, Frank Matthews. Tonight's special show brings you our very own Ron Chepsik and his colleagues, Lou Rice, Dave O'Flaherty, and Clint T. Shorty Buse, and Mike Pizzi. They'll all talk about their award-winning documentary DVD on the legendary Frank Matthews. More about them and their important film in just a few moments. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron is an award-winning author, documentary producer, and director publisher. He's a two-time Fulbright scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia, and a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series. His book, Sergeant Smack, has been optioned for a movie. His latest project is the just-released documentary, The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. For more information, please go to Strategic Media Books. That's www.strategicmediabooks.com. Given his books, his extensive travels, and in-depth interviews, Ron Chepsik today is the leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Get out there and buy his books, and be sure to check out his documentary DVDs. You won't be disappointed. Also, be sure to visit his website at www.ronchepsik.com. You can also join him on Facebook and Twitter. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio on my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he's a contributing writer to several trade publications. Last year, he published Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay area, with Volume 2 coming out next year. And this summer, he'll publish another book about the famous Gonalda shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. Always a good promo. You're getting to be a real pro at it. Our book, Movers and Mavericks, is selling like ice-cold beer on a hot day in Coney Island. Thanks very much, Ronnie. Well, Ron, it's going to be a great show tonight, so we invite our listeners to stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. Just before we reach into our mailbag and read some mail we received, I'd like to thank all our listeners out there from around the world, that's around the globe, for tuning into Crime Beat. We're thrilled and delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments and thumbs up about our program. We're averaging over 130,000 listeners every week, now in from over 100 countries, and that is certainly something to cheer about. I'd like to thank all our production people at Artists First World Radio Network, in particular Corey, Scott, and Tony for making this show possible. Also, a special thanks to the Ryan Brothers for allowing us to use their music as our theme song. Like I said many times before, Ronnie, internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're right on track. Tonight's show is brought to you by Rolly's Cuban Cigars up here in Thunder Bay. All of you Americans coming up for an exciting fishing adventure, make sure you stop by Rolly's on May Street in Thunder Bay, Canada, and check out his fine Cuban cigar selection. Well, Ronnie, now here is this week's mailbag. This one's from Casey of New Orleans, Louisiana. Casey writes, "Holy cow, you guys had quite the troop on last week's show. I enjoyed learning about the notorious gangster named Frank Matthews. Always been a great fan of this kind of story. But as Will stated, if this mobster is still alive, he's bound to get caught sooner or later. They all do. Hey, Ronnie, you've been researching this guy for years. Do you think he's still alive?"
First of all, I've got a comment on a Cuban cigar. That's why they call the show Crime Beat, right?
Right on.
Hey, well, I mean, later, right? I mean, later is 40 years. Next year will be the 40th year anniversary of Frank, so they're going to catch him sooner or later. And, of course, that's what we hear from some of the law enforcement we interviewed. But we're going to get the take of our experts on the Frank Matthews story tonight and tell us it can't be sooner, so it has to be later. If it is going to be later, okay?
You bet. Well, you know, Ronnie, 40 years is a long time, and you never know. Well, Ronnie, you want to give our listeners out there in that wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show.
Great. Next week we have Linda Scarpa, who is on the TV show I Married a Mobster. She's the daughter of Grace Scarpa, the Grim Reaper, one of the most vicious mobsters in mafia history. And she's going to be talking about her life as a daughter of a big-time mobster, and that should be very interesting. And then we'll switch gears, and we'll have Malcolm Kushner on, and he's put together a book called The Official Book of Mob Humor. And gangsters do have humor. I guess it can be funny, too, when they're not killing people or robbing them or doing something else to them, right? So we'll have him on, and we'll look at his book and maybe get a few laughs down the down the road with him.
Yeah, well, it's about time we had a few laughs on the show, Ronnie, I'll tell you. Well, as you know, Ronnie, as you know.
Here, I'll tell you.
Well, I tell you, we've had a lot of serious stuff. Great shows.
Yeah.
Really great. As you know, Ronnie, the beat to crime never stops. It never, never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet features a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. And crime news you might have missed. Now, here is this week's rap sheet item. Dateline, April 29th, 2012, New York City. Terrorist plots hatched by the FBI. Hey, Ronnie, the United States has been narrowly saved from lethal terrorist plots in recent years. Or so it has seemed. A would-be suicide bomber was intercepted on his way to the Capitol. A scheme to bomb synagogues and shoot Stinger missiles at military aircraft was developed by men in Newburgh, New York. And a fanciful idea to fly explosive-laden models. Hey, Ronnie, is this stuff all made up? What's going on?
Yeah, this is really incredible. What the news missed, I think, is that the FBI's bureaucracy. Like, and I worked in a bureaucracy for 20-odd years in the university. And you got to do something, right? Turn your pay, turn your budget, earn your salary. So I guess they figure, manufacturing terrorist plots, encouraging really dumbasses. If you look at some of these terrorist plots that were concocted, will help them make them look good. Whether or not they would do them without the prodding of the FBI is a big question. Another big question is, why aren't they chasing real terrorists that are trying to destroy our way of life?
Yeah, well, I guess it's keeping a lot of FBI guys still employed.
Well, yeah, it creates employment, I guess.
I'm telling
that.
You.
But,
yeah.
Maybe some of these plots could have been serious, but if you read, the characters that were involved, I mean, just unbelievable dumb, the movie would be Dumb, Dumber, and Dumbest.
That's right. Anyway, it's a fascinating and an extraordinary story. Well, let's keep an eye on that one. Now, just before we get on to our special guest, we'll take a station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. All our shows are archived for 24/7 listening, so if you missed one, you can check us out anytime. If you have any questions for our guests, you can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We also would be glad to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, Crime Beat's featured guests tonight are Lou Rice, Dave O'Flaherty, Clinton Shorty Boozy, Mike Pizzi, and you. Hey, you guys are going to talk about your great documentary, The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. Tonight's broadcast will focus on the flight and disappearance of notorious gangster almost 40 years ago. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Hey, Ron.
Thanks.
Real enthusiastic bunch here tonight. Please introduce yourself. Give your credentials and what you and who you are. Introduce your name so people get familiar with your voice, and then your credentials briefly. Lou, start off with you.
Sure, Lou Rice. I'm former special agent with the Drug Enforcement Administration. Served 26 years as a special agent. with assignments in New York City, Kingston, Jamaica, Miami, Philadelphia, and Detroit, and Washington, D.C.
Right. And Lou was also involved with the investigation of Frank Matthews in Philadelphia, New York, and we'll talk about that later. How about you, Mike?
Mike Pizzi, retired United States Marshal from the Eastern District of New York in Brooklyn. That's where the Matthews case was being handled. Played a role in the fugitive hunt for Matthews.
And, as the marshals, which took over from the DEA, right?
Yes.
And what year was 30 years
on the job.
30 years on the job. What year did the marshals take over from the DEA?
Well, officially, we took over in 1979, but anybody who failed to appear in court when a warrant was issued, we generally had the instruction to go out and try and apprehend them. So I would say we did our cursory go out and try and find the guy that didn't show up routine right away when Matthews didn't show. But in depth, as an investigation, I would guess somewhere in late 74, and then officially in 79.
And Dave?
Hi, Ron. I'm Dave O'Flaherty, retired chief deputy, Eastern District of New York, which also I was the supervisor of the fugitive squad during the time that we looked for Matthews. And I had 27 years with the Marshal Service in Brooklyn.
Part one. I mean, excuse me, the Frank Matthews story, the DVD, but when we do part two, he will be definitely in that one. I don't think Shorty is here, right? Shorty is not here. Okay, so last week we left the story, and we had Matthews being arrested in Las Vegas, posting an incredible $5 million bond, and he was brought back to New York. The bond was reduced to $325,000. The law enforcement was really upset about it because they knew that Matthews had the money to raise, and he also had plenty of friends back in Durham and in the hood to raise that money, and he did. He stayed out on his own for about 5 to 6 months, and then on July 2nd, 1973. He fled. And my first question, I guess I'll ask Lou this, was it unusual for a big-time gangster like Frank Matthews to jump bail and expect to get away?
Well, Ron, I think you have to look at the history of gangsters that get arrested and are afforded bail. Judges determine whether bail is going to be in the cards for the gangsters, and sometimes they'll stick around depending on how they feel the strength of the cases, their financial means, people they know in the organization that may be potential witnesses against them and cooperate. So they have to weigh a lot of factors. And if they think the case that the government has is airtight and there's no wiggle room, that might give them an added incentive to flee. During that time, Matthews became a fugitive before DEA was formed as an agency. Prior to DEA was the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, and in July of 73, then President Nixon, formed the Drug Enforcement Administration. So he was subject number one as a fugitive when the agency was formed. And so there was an aggressive manhunt to try to locate him after he left court in Brooklyn that day in July.
Dave O'Flaherty, do you think, looking back, the case was airtight against him? He was indicted, a lot of people thought that there was a lot of evidence against him. Obviously, he obviously wouldn't indict him. What do you think, in retrospect, that he, from his perspective, make the right move in terms of preserving his freedom?
Well, obviously, he made the right move. We haven't found him yet. But I believe the government had a strong case. I believe that the task force, the DEA and city and state, put together an excellent case. And I'm sure Frank knew it, too. And with the amount of funds that he had available, he made a decision that, as we look at it right now, was a real smart one. and he hasn't been found yet.
Right. You mentioned the funds, Mike. The figure is 15 to 20 million. How do we know that he had that amount of money when he fled?
Well, that's what the intelligence people had reported to us. I mean, we got most of our information from the intelligence folks. But let me make a point. You mentioned that he took off in 73. It was actually in 74, July, or January 74, according to my notes.
No, it was actually January, because it was the Super Bowl. He was arrested on his way to the Super Bowl between Miami and Washington Redskins, which Miami won 14.
That's the first arrest, but then I think it was about a year between the time that the next warrant was issued after he made bail.
The failure to appear warrant, I believe, was issued the first week of January 1974.
Correct.
Okay, on that. But he fled before that, right?
He was gone, and then when he didn't appear in court, that's when they issued the warrant.
Right,
that's kind of the way it goes.
Right.
But let me say this to you. You ask if us people generally would run away. Now, next week you're going to have Linda Scarpa on the show?
Yeah.
Well, Gregory Scarpa's other son, Greg Jr.,
right,
he ran away too. And then we caught him. So, I mean, we've had a lot of them run away. Some of them were out there for 7 years. Some were out there for a little longer. But generally speaking, we did find a way to catch most of them. This is a very unusual case where we've never had a substantiated lead on a guy. And to me, it's troubling because after watching your documentary, and learning some things that I didn't know about for the first time, I'm changing my opinion as to whether or not he may be alive.
I'm going to join you.
not only has he hasn't been seen, Cheryl Brown hasn't been seen either, or by any we never were able to confirm that she's been spotted. So for both of them to disappear. He either did a really good job of planning, or they're not with us any longer.
Right. Well, there's two questions I want to ask here, because we're jumping a little ahead of ourselves with Cheryl Brown. First, do you think, and I think there's debate about this, that he was, and I'm going to ask Lou this question, that he actually had a plan of action, or if at the last moment he decided that he was going to go down and then made a run for it. What do you think, Lou?
No, I think he had a plan, Ron. I was not involved in the initial investigation of Frank, which led to his arrest, but I definitely got involved when he was a fugitive. And my information, coming from the agents that detective that worked on the investigation, he's an extremely bright guy and a great leader and a guy that would quickly determine what's in his best interest. And knowing that he was facing significant jail time because he was the leader of the organization. I think he added up very quickly rather than give all his money to a lawyer and risk the opportunity of going to jail. It would be better to develop a very strong escape plan and stay under the radar for a strong period of time and hopefully evade getting arrested. So I think he was, focused on, hey, I may go to jail for a significant amount of time. It's no secret to anybody in a large conspiracy case, and we had several co-defendants, that sooner or later somebody may get tagged and want to cooperate against him, and all the breaks are going to go to somebody that can cooperate and give up the leader of the organization, and he was the leader. So as the leader, he was a definite target for the government and also for other people in the organization that figured they'd mitigate their jail time by giving information against him.
Right. Now, what about you gentlemen? First, Dave, do you concur with Lou's opinion?
I do. I concur with what he said. I believe when he was initially arrested, he may not have had a real game plan. He might have just been thinking about it, but between the time he was released on bail in the Eastern District of New York and the time he failed to show, I'm sure he was gathering up all his funds and is making his contacts wherever he was headed, which I believe was South America. And that's when I believe he put the final plan into effect. The final plan meaning the one to escape, and who knows what happened afterwards. But I do basically agree with what Lou said.
Right. What about you, Mike? You concur as well?
Yeah, what bothers me the most is the fact that I don't believe he had a strong plan in the beginning, but later on he probably developed one. But what bothers me most is that we've never had a reliable, confirmed sighting or anything that we could put our finger on to say, hey, this is a real lead. I don't think we've ever discussed this one, but I just want to share it with you.
Sure,
there was a rumor early on that he had somehow dyed his skin. And, of course, we all giggled about it, but, you know, there was always a possibility that could be true. And then we saw what Michael Jackson was able to do with however he did his skin.
Right.
And maybe that was real. But, again, no confirmation, just stories.
Right. Well, to reiterate for our listeners what Mike just said, there's not a confirmed sighting, which is really remarkable in 40 years, right? I mean, that's unbelievable when you consider, like, Whitey Bulger, you know, there was a sighting with him, and usually something shows up that indicates
yeah.
that the person's alive or dead. But in Frank Matthews' case, there's absolutely nothing on that. Now, Sherrod Brown, that's the other intriguing part, which makes the story more incredible as you get into it. Frank, as we discussed last week, had a common law wife, Barbara Hinton, and three kids at home, but he was also a womanizer, incredible sexual appetite. He had women in practically every city that his drug network reached. And he evidently had this relationship with Cheryl Denise Brown. And Dave, can you describe who is this woman and how she fit into the Frank Matthews story and what happened?
Well, my understanding of Cheryl was that she was an extremely attractive young lady, and she ran into Frank at, I'm not positive, what club, whatever, and they struck up a relationship, and I believe she became his main squeeze. And she was with him during the period that he was out in Vegas. And then basically, I believe, and Lou can add more to this, I believe there came a point where a material witness warrant was issued for her, because I don't believe they had anything on her as far as the drug case went. But
right, that's when we were at the marshal's office. That's what they said they had on her. And
yeah, and
right.
And at that point, everyone that I ever spoke to always alluded to the fact that when he left, she left. And also, my information in the beginning of the investigation, the fugitive part of it, was that Gaddis Hinton also
right.
fled with at the same time. He subsequently was captured many years later, and never did cooperate like almost 99% of the people that we interviewed. Gaddis happened to disappear around the same time. I don't believe that he was with Frank,
right?
But he found it around the same time that Frank and Cheryl did.
Right.
Cheryl didn't abscond; she just left with Frank.
Right. I didn't mention Gaddis Hinton. I didn't want to complicate this, because I think that most people think that he didn't really leave with him. It was just a coincidence on that. But Cheryl Brown, I mean, she was really a beauty, as we pointed out in the documentary.
She came from a very nice family in Queens, New York. I believe both of her parents were educators. And numerous times I interviewed them, they appeared to be sincere in their indication that they had never heard from her. They hadn't heard from her in a number of years, and they maintained that. They left New York, retired, and traveled south. And I still believe they are still claiming they've never heard from their daughter in all these years. So one would, you know, you could think a lot of different reasons why, but if she's alive, I would have thought she might have contacted him once, twice. They claim she hasn't, so who knows.
And did the marshals believe that story? That they?
Well, I can't tell you what the marshals today believe.
All right.
But I could tell you, as the marshal in charge of the case, mm-hmm. I believed them at the time. They,
right.
You know, when it wasn't an interview over a telephone. It was a face-to-face. And they appeared to be sincere and concerned about their daughter's welfare.
Right. Well, what years did you serve on the investigation of the Frank Matthews disappearance?
Well, I actually was with the team that went out the day he didn't appear in court. And that, I believe that was sometime in October of 74.
Right.
I could be wrong. You know, I don't have any case files or anything like that.
Right.
But I think it was, it could have been before October
right.
of 74.
Right.
Sometime
well,
in 74.
Put it this way, it was a long time ago.
Yeah, a long time ago.
a long time ago. Before I get to Mike, I think Mike might have a different opinion. Lou, do you want to add anything on the Cheryl Denise connection?
Yeah, just something about futures in general, Ron.
Okay.
You know, as time goes on, the universe of people that are intimately familiar with the fugitive gets less and less. And so there's a generation of agents and detectives that are in the narcotics business now that really wouldn't have this fellow Frank or his girlfriend Cheryl on the top of their mind. You know, the guys with intimate knowledge are all retired, and they're not in the game anymore for the most part.
So, Lou, are you trying to get the old guys back?
Hey,
Ronnie, I got a quick one, if you don't mind here.
Yeah, here's the question. Willie's got a question. Go ahead, Willie.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't any secret. It wasn't no secret that Frank Matthews had, he was a target by his rivals. You know, some of his close lieutenants were killed, assassinated. One famous situation was one of these guys was killed in front of 800 people at a nightclub, and there wasn't one witness to come forward. Could this have been the catalyst for Frank to say, "Hey, listen, I'm not too safe around here. I'm going to plan my escape." Any comments on that, guys?
Well, Willie, this is Lou Wright. That's not unusual in the criminal world. You know, even today in 2012, in certain areas, you'll have a murder committed in front of numerous witnesses, and for obvious reasons, people feel that they don't want to give that person up. You know, that's not so unusual, you know, in terms of people that do not have a case on them not wanting to cooperate with law enforcement.
Right.
They don't want to go to the hassle. They don't want to be identified as pointing the person out that, you know, maybe is putting money around in the neighborhood and taking care of certain people, and they're sort of giving that up. So that's not totally unusual where, you know, people are a witness to a crime and for whatever reason develop Alzheimer's.
And I agree with, this is Mike, I agree with Lou on that. I don't think anybody scared him out of town. I think the government was the ones that might have scared him out of town. I don't think it was his rivals.
Right. Let me add something, Ron.
Okay.
Anybody that I spoke to in all the different states that I traveled to, I never heard a bad word about him. And I'm talking about the people that were in the business with him. I believe he took care of the people around him. It's my understanding anybody that laid out his money, he gave it all back. He treated the people that worked for him very well, and they all had good things to say about him. So he might be one of those rare characters, and obviously he's gone almost 40 years, so there was something unique about him.
Right.
But
no one that I
interviewed ever told me that someone was out to kill him or they believed he was killed, which doesn't mean he wasn't, but I never got any of these other people that were in the drug business tell me that.
Right.
So I don't know what that's worth, but that's my feeling on it, that no one that I spoke to, and I spoke to many,
right,
had a bad thing to say.
Right. Well, one of the things that I found really interesting in researching this story and talking to you guys is that I didn't get a sense that there were really any informants. Is that true? Which is really quite unusual, right? I mean, nobody's stepping forward to make a deal or somebody that had it out for Frank, as you pointed out. He was very popular. We talked about that last week at the last show.
There were informants in the case, and Lou, if you want to take over,
but I mean, coming forward and saying, you know, he's in the Barbados, or he's
let me say this, Ron. You know, this was a case from the early 70s,
right?
And we sort of turned the spotlight back on in Philadelphia in the 90s,
right?
And then again in New York. So I mean, that didn't happen just by happenstance,
right?
Now, without going into too much detail,
right? Before we move on and get into the hunt, I think Mike had a contrary opinion about Carol Denise Brown, right? Because you mentioned in the documentary that you weren't sure she left with him.
Well, we didn't have a definitive, somebody said, I saw those two get on the plane, or I saw those two. We never had a confirmation. But I have to assume that she left with him.
Right.
It's just an assumption. But again, we have no confirmation of anything here. And I don't want to repeat words that we used before, but they do seem like they fell off the edge of the earth. I mean, they're gone.
That's right. Let's take a break, Willie, and we'll get back to the hunt. We'll move into the hunt. Go
you
ahead,
bet, Ray. Ronnie. That's great. What a fascinating interview. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Harib. Our very special guests this evening are Lou Rice, Mike Pizzi, and Dave Flaherty, and our very own Ronnie Chepsik. Now back to our show.
Right. We're talking with our expert sources on the Frank Matthews story. It's based on a documentary, which was done by Alan Bradley and myself, produced by us. It's called The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. You can go to frankmatthewsstory.com. Instant digital download for $7.99 if you want. And I should mention, Lou, you got a book, right?
Oh, sure do, Frank. Ron, definitely. It's
go
called
ahead. Mention the title.
DEA,
get it.
DEA Special Agent, My Life on the Front Line by Lou Rice.
Right. And you go to Amazon to get it?
Amazon, yes, has it. And just gives a brief overview of my career with the DEA and the focus of the agency during my 26 years there.
Great. Okay, thank you, Lou. Now, we set the stage. You know, he's leaving with, we believe, $15 to $20 million and probably with Cheryl Denise Brown. And he jumps bail. He makes it out of New York. What happened to him, you know, in the subsequent immediate months after he fled for New York? Because you must have been pretty confident that you were going to catch up with this guy, right?
Who are you directing this to?
I'm going to direct the question to you, Mike.
Well, again, like, not to repeat, but normally when somebody doesn't show up for court, your mind races and something might have happened. Maybe he was pinched. Maybe he's drunk. Maybe he just got nervous. So you do all the normal things you usually do when somebody doesn't show up, and sometimes you hit the guy. I mean, you get him right in his house, or he's drunk, or he's laid up in a hotel, or he's just scared, and he walks in the door the next day. So all of those things were done. And then starts a more in-depth investigation. So I have to say that the investigation basically took off like most, and then it gets more complicated, and it gets more serious, and then, of course, you pull out all the plugs.
Right.
But that's kind of the way things start.
Right. Lou, a Syntac 2 was set up for him, right?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Can you explain to the listeners what a Syntac is and how big it is and important it is in terms of hunting down gangsters, and a little background on that and how it related
sure.
to that?
The Syntac was a program in DEA in the early years where they would put together a special select group of experienced agents and target an individual or an organization. And they would spend all their man hours, day in and night, trying to develop witnesses and working closely with the federal prosecutors to put together a prosecutable case where they could indict and charge this the leader and the other members of the organization at the highest level of federal crimes. And they were excused of all other assignments, all other investigations, but just to focus on this one particular individual. And that's really a statement of the significance that the United States government placed on the Frank Matthews and his organization. And you have to realize in context during that time, the city and the country was getting overwhelmed with heroin and heroin addicts, and primarily New York City being ground zero for that.
Right. But the point is the DEA and then the marshals devoted significant resources to trying to get this guy, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole federal government, every agency.
Right.
You know, and knowing that he had international contacts, that especially in South America, you know, working with local police officials in South America, you know, it was a full court press to try to get him and bring him back into federal court.
Right. Now, Dave, do you think he left the country or he remained in the country after he fled New York City?
Well, I would only be guessing, but seeing the contacts he had out of the country, especially in South America and in parts of Europe, I would imagine that with the amount of money he had, he eventually, I don't really think he fled immediately out of the country. I'm thinking he might have just left the city because he was on in the city. Might have went to a waiting location, spent a little time there, and then got his documents together, whatever he needed to travel, and left. But as Lou was saying, it was a major effort by the government, and there are things called like an Interpol watch that's put out, and you know, this goes all around the world, and all of these entities that were involved, all the different agencies, they basically covered all the bases. So it wasn't just like a couple of guys in New York with the DEA and a couple of marshals in New York. It was nationwide. It was worldwide. Of course, that doesn't happen day one. It takes a period of time to coordinate all these things. But he was already in the wind, but it was court press by a number of different agencies, and it wasn't just in the New York area.
Right.
Hey, Ronnie, I just got an email here from a fellow, one of our listeners. If you don't mind, I'm going to read it, and maybe one of the guys could answer it.
Okay.
This is from Donald of Atlanta, Georgia. Donald writes, Frank Matthews was reputed to have a hell of a lot of money when he fled. Have the authorities found any of it? Any comments from our guests on that question from Donald?
Good question.
Answer, no.
We'll start with Mike, and then...
No, we didn't find any of his money.
Right. Is that unusual? I mean, isn't there some kind of trail that, you know, a guy flees, you know, a bail, there's some kind of trail. I mean, and then the fact that there is absolutely no trail, I mean, the money, we're talking $15, $20 million. I mean, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, I don't want to say there's no trail. I mean, he had property. I believe the government forfeited the property.
Right.
If he had cash money and he's a fugitive, of course, they don't have his body and they don't have the money either.
Right.
But, you know, there's a lot, as you can imagine, that goes on in an investigation in terms of getting information from accomplice, witnesses, people, part of the organization that obviously you're not going to reveal. And sometimes you will maybe miss putting the handcuffs on a fellow by a mere matter of minutes. And so there could be a couple of near misses during the course of the investigation.
Right.
But as Dave said earlier, I mean, this was a worldwide manhunt. I mean, there were people in the U.S., people in overseas. And I think you have to always remember when DEA conducts an investigation and arrests somebody, that's an arrest after at least 6 months of investigation. It's not like they watch somebody and say, this guy's a major drug dealer, let's arrest him. No. They've been following this guy, interacting with this guy through either an undercover agent or other means, wiretaps. And so they know basically his organization, They know people he's doing business with. They've been working with a federal prosecutor, and they're going to charge him. So they know a lot about him when they arrest him. And when he would become a fugitive, they try to go to different areas where they felt that, you know, he felt comfortable because they know about these places during the course of the investigation. But obviously, 40 years later, he's not arrested. And I just want to comment something that Mike and Dave said. Ron, I told you initially, you know, I thought he was alive. But
right.
After, you know, watching the DVD and you and Al did a great job talking to a variety of sources and seeing that thing for about an hour, I'd have to, and especially how he was operating during that time in the early 70s, I would think he might be dead. You know, I'm changing my opinion. He might be dead.
I kind of agree with what Lou just told you. There were some things that we learned from the DVD that we were not privy to early on in the case, particularly the involvement of the Corsicans and the intervention by people in Justice Department and the CIA. So, I mean, we were not privy to that.
Right. So how would you think that would relate to the mystery of Frank Matthews?
Well, let me just add one thing. Both these fellows just touched on it briefly, and I'm not going to tell you anything that you really the public shouldn't know.
Right.
But just assume that the government has this vast intelligence network, okay? Mm-hmm. And assume that what I'm telling you is true. Mm-hmm. That all of the resources of all the intelligence community were put to work trying to find Matthews. Just assume for a moment that in this intelligence network, you could tell the tail number of a plane that an individual took.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way the reports are read or written. I mean, that's how much effort was put into this. And so we still haven't got a solid lead on the guy. So now... and I, too, am changing my opinion that he may not be alive.
Right.
Hey, Ronnie, I got another email here. One of the guys was talking about South America, and this one is from Hortensia, her name is, of Rio de Janeiro. She writes, Rio de Janeiro has a historic culture of criminals, political and mafia types fleeing to our city of almost 7 million. With a strong African presence on our population, have law enforcement made any efforts to try to find Frank Matthews here? And what's the possibility that he's living here in Rio? Any comments?
Right, Dave. Go ahead, Dave.
This is Dave. I still believe Frank's alive, and with his contacts in South America, the guy's name eludes me now, but he was very close to one of his suppliers. And Frank, when he was a young man, had, I believe, I read this in one of the reports that either the task force or DEA wrote, that he, young fella, child in school, always wanted to live in South America. Lou, you might be more in tune with that story, but he always wanted to go to South America, and I believe where he ended up going. Now, whether he stepped off the plane and was met by a guy with a pair of sunglasses and they did him in and stole his money, that might be true. But my personal belief is that's where he went, and that's where he's been staying.
Right. Well, let me add something before Lou, you could comment. Someone told me that, which I didn't know, Venezuela evidently has a large retirement group of African Americans that retire there, military, government workers, and all that. And someone told me that, you know, that it could possibly have been a nice place for Frank to disappear into this group, you know, that was living there, this colony of Americans. Do you know anything about that?
No, I'm not familiar with that, Ron. But I do know. I mean, you'd have to imagine if somebody knows that they're wanted. And if they change their behavior and keep a low profile and obey the rules and the norms of the particular town that they live in, I mean, the chance of coming up on anybody's radar is going to be significantly low.
Right.
Right. So, and when you think about Matthews, you got to think about a smart guy, knowing that if he gets caught, he's probably going to go back to jail for the rest of his life. And obviously, because he fled, he's not a guy that wants to go to jail. He doesn't want to be confined. So he's smart. There's some guys that you met and we know that they could cooperate, get the break of a lifetime, and wind up right back in federal prison. And there are other guys that we know that get the break of a lifetime, and you doubt if you'll ever see them back in federal prison. They will significantly change their behavior. Rondo Matthews, wherever he goes, you know, time is on his side. And after 40 years, you know, unless somebody saw the DVD and got a little interested and asked a couple of questions and did some research on the Internet and said that could be and sent the lead to law enforcement and they followed up on it, you know, he may be the big fish that has gotten away.
Correct.
Hey, Ron. Let me just follow up on one thing.
Before we start, let's take a break, and then we'll let you follow up on that.
All right.
Let's take a break, Willie.
You bet. What a great interview. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb. Now back to Ron Chepsik and our guests for the remainder of the program.
Thank you, Willie. And we're talking with sources from the documentary that was produced by Al Prophet Bradley and myself, the Frank Matthews story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. You can go to frankmatthewsstory.com for instant digital download or to buy a physical copy of the documentary. It's also available on Amazon.com and many distribution outlets on that. Mike, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just want to follow up on what Lou said. I'm just finishing reading a book about the boss of bosses of the Sicilian Mafia, a guy by the name of Bernardo Provenzano, was a fugitive in Sicily for 40 years. 40 years.
Wow.
Until he was apprehended. Not saying they weren't hard, they're working hard looking for him, but he managed to elude the authorities for 40 years and still was running his organization.
Wow.
They at least had verifiable, confirmed sources that identified certain things, times, and places that assured them that he was still active and alive. There were times when they thought he was dead, too.
Right.
But here, I'm telling you that we've never had one.
Yeah, that's right on that. And what about plastic surgery? You know, there's that's another thing that, you know, some people believe he had plastic surgery. Do you think he did that?
I think anything's possible. I mean, the fact that we heard this rumor so many years ago about the skin tone, and we didn't know anything about that stuff. I mean, kind of never heard of it and kind of laughed it off. I mean, we put it in our reports and we said there was a possibility, but and then all of a sudden we take a look and here's Michael Jackson, whose skin got extremely light, had some sort of chemical work done on him. Anything was possible.
Right, on that. Now, it was, you did have people that came forward and claimed to see him. I'm going to direct this question to Lou because we're talking about an ABC journalist, right, that claimed that he saw him in the either the Barbados or Bermuda, right, Lou?
I think that was Dave.
Oh.
Yeah.
Luke?
You want me to talk?
Yeah, back on.
Yeah. I was asking about the.
There was a well-known.
Oh, Dave. Okay, Dave.
Television news reporter from New York City.
Right.
Who I spoke with. He said he was in the Bahamas, and I'm trying to remember when it was, but he was in the Bahamas, and he was at a bar in the Bahamas, and it was a fairly large place. He looks across this, as he described it, kind of a U-shaped, or oval bar, a lot of people. He looks across and he sees this fella with a couple of attractive women, and he says that it was Frank Matthews. He knew of him because he was in New York on the evening news for many years. He was also a retired detective before he got into the news business. And he said that it was Frank. And, you know, he didn't do anything about it at the time. He also indicated it was somewhat of a nod or an acknowledgement, which I don't know if he was trying to make it a little more interesting to me, but that he believed that Frank acknowledged who he was, and that was it. He gets back to New York a short time later, and he contacts somebody who I'm not clear if it was somebody in the NYPD, his former, or if it was somebody in the DEA. But nothing ever was confirmed, just that story of when it comes to that fella.
And this guy wasn't a nut, right? I mean, this guy was a journalist.
Oh, no, he was a well-known African-American TV news journalist. He's on the evening news every night in New York for many years. So he was a well-known New York news person. He wasn't a nut, and that's what he said. And that was probably sometime in the 80s.
Right.
And I don't have a date, I'm sorry.
Okay, well that's still an interesting, and I know I've talked to people that claim...
Actually, it was 1978 to 1980 in that time
that
frame.
Period, which is still relatively close to his flight on that. But I've been in Durham, and I've talked to people that claimed he's been in Durham, and you know, he attended a funeral dressed as a woman, and there's some other stories.
That's not going to happen with Frank. He's not dressing as a woman.
Right. I mean, that's that question of debate. Is, you know, would Frank do that? You know, macho Frank, or that, or would he, you know, have such a sense of humor that he would show up on that?
Because after this goes on the air, he'll probably surrender just to prove he never dressed as a woman.
Well, Lou, we're moving towards the end of our interview here.
Okay.
You opened reopened the investigation twice. And,
right.
What was the reason for that?
Without going into a whole lot of specific detail, but obviously DEA, like all law enforcement agencies, especially an investigative one, you survive off information. And not only did we reopen it, but we got a hold of Frank Bender, who was instrumental in creating the bust, the facial bust of John List.
Forensic sculptor, right?
Displayed, yes, forensic sculptor, which was prominently displayed on America's Most Wanted one Sunday night with John Waltz, and within 3 days he was in custody. And, you know, we gave him, Frank Bender, the information we had on and pictures of Frank Matthews, and you know, about his lifestyle and habits, and you know, he created a bust which we used with the information that we were receiving at that time in New York, and put together a group of agents in the task force and said, hey, we need to freshen up these leads, we need a good look, new pair of eyes. They traveled to North Carolina, other cities, spoke to a lot of people. I think if you talk to some of those guys now, they felt, and this is in the 90s anyway, that he was definitely alive.
Right on that. And but in the end, you know, nothing happened. I mean,
in the end, no, he's not in federal custody. No,
that's right. We're finishing up here, and it's really interesting because. And I'm one of those. I'm leaning towards the fact that he's not alive because of the evidence. I just find it hard to believe. You know, talking to you guys again and again, that you cannot come up with something, you know, to prove one way or another. And the only thing I can conclude is that, you know, either he's the smartest guy that ever lived, which you know, may
yeah,
not
but,
possible.
But,
or
but one thing you gotta have to remember, Ron, he's not on the top 10 list either, you know.
But that's
and
true.
The generation of guys in the game are looking at a 30, 35-year-old photograph of this guy.
Right.
And you know, everybody's gonna change in 30 years.
Right, and I don't know whether anybody's really looking for him, because one of the things that was really a shocker was that Barbara Hinton had passed away in 2003, and nobody that I interviewed knew about it, including myself, and I finally talked to a family member. And they told me that fact. So,
Well, I can tell you, I talked to those guys, still talk to those guys in DEA that have the case, and especially most recently after you produced this this great DVD, and they are still looking for him.
Right, right. And it's an open-ended question, and we can continue talking about this fascinating subject, but we're going to have to stop there. And all I can say that... Frank Matthews, if you're still out there, Willie and I would love to have you on the show.
Yeah, we'll buy you a cigar. Don't worry, we'll buy a couple of cigars.
Right. Right.
And you don't have to come dressed as a woman, Frank.
You don't have to come dressed as a woman, right?
Yeah.
And you guys were really great guests tonight, and
great
we could
guest.
Talk about this. I guess it's like debating the existence of God. In a way, you never reach a conclusion, you know, depending on your point of view on that. So we'll leave it there, and if anything else comes up and relating to the Matthew story, we'll have you back on. Thank you again,
yeah.
Gentlemen.
And let me just say one thing. It was a pleasure for me to reconnect with Mike and Dave. And when you look at the transformation in New York City, a lot of that is because of the work that we DEA did with the U.S. Marshals, going after some of New York and the world's toughest gangsters.
Right. Well,
thanks, Lou. Thanks. Same here.
And remember, you can get a copy of the Frank Matthews story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. Go to frankmatthewsmovie.com for instant digital download for $7.99. You can also purchase a physical copy there or Amazon. And Willie, we'll go on with the show.
You bet. Well, thanks, fellas.
And thanks, Willie. And Willie, I am in Coney Island, and I
hey,
do have
way to go.
Beer.
and before you gentlemen leave, if you go to Thunder Bay, Willie will supply you with a Cuban cigar.
Absolutely.
Okay,
we're going.
My pleasure. Well, thanks, Ronnie,
so
and thanks
on.
Again. We're a very featured,
all right.
Great guest.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Willie and Ron, it's been a pleasure. Okay,
you bet,
you
guys. Way to go. Way to go. Now,
go ahead,
Ronnie, what did you learn tonight from our guests?
I learned that I'm still baffled by the Frank Matthews story. And like I said, people have changed their minds since we came out of that documentary about whether he's alive or dead. And I just hope I don't go crazy. I'm trying to find the answer to that question. How about you, Willie?
Well, you know what? $20 million buys a lot of disappearance money. That's if he's alive. He could be anywhere in the world. But frankly, I think he's a goner. He's met his maker a long time ago, but you never know. Now, Ronnie, at this time, we're going to bring you our Crime Beat's Dumb Crook of the Month segment. Sadly, marriage isn't forever anymore. Divorce isn't forever either. So what's the solution? Burn it all. According to a Texas newspaper, a young woman started by giving her husband a sensual massage and ended up setting him on fire, and not metaphorically. Turns out the oil she had been rubbing on him was actually gasoline, which came in handy when she put one of the romance-inducing candles to his skin. He was rushed to the hospital as their home burned down. Evidence suggests that the attempted murder was premeditated, and she was arrested on charges of arson and aggravated assault. Holy smokes, Ronnie! That story's one for the ages.
All I can say is that this story had one hell of a climax in it. On that, but who's dumber, right? I mean, you're trying to use gasoline or him, you know, not being able to see that she was using gasoline. He had a problem with his nose and smell and all that.
Wow.
We keep coming up with these stories and they just get dumber and dumber.
That's why they call it Dumb Crook of the Month segment. Now, just a reminder for all you listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for May the 10th. Our guest will be Linda Scarpa, who appeared on television's I Married a Mobster. Linda Scarpa will discuss her life as the daughter of the infamous and notorious mobster Greg Scarpa. On the second part of our show, we'll have Malcolm Kushner, author of the official book of Mob Humor. It's going to be another great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss this one. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and yours truly. For all of you out there, you can listen to all our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are, we would like to thank all of you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Chapsik and myself, Will Harib, we hope you tune in to Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.